This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Because of what happened in the past, it's more likely to be related to your mining events or your mining activity and the fact that we're starting to get these mines starting to fill up with water.
That was Michelle Grobler, a South Africa seismologist, talking about the earthquake that hit Johannesburg. Details coming up. Also, we get an update on conditions in Sudan, and rebel groups kill more than 50 people in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Fighting continues in Sudan's capital Khartoum and other areas. At least 2,000 civilians are believed to have died in the combat that began 2 months ago between Sudan's military and the paramilitary rapid support forces. The battle has left millions of people facing shortages of food, water, and medicine. The spokesperson of the International Committee of the Red Cross in East Africa says humanitarian conditions across some parts of Sudan, including the western region of Darfur, are dire. Aliono Senko says telecommunication glitches coupled with the fighting have prevented aid workers from getting accurate information about the humanitarian situation across the country.
What we're seeing, unfortunately, in Khartoum, but also in other places affected by the conflict, like Darfur, is that the fighting is ongoing. And this exacerbates the already dire humanitarian situation for Sudanese civilians, because now they have been facing almost 2 months of uninterrupted fighting with very little respite. And that, unfortunately, just makes the same humanitarian problems that they were already facing just making them worse.
Regarding this situation where you are working with your local partners to resolve some of these difficult challenges, is there any dead toll that is out there or the bodies that have been collected so far from the streets of Khartoum?
I don't have the most updated figure on me that I can share. I think they have collected more than 100. And unfortunately, also getting the most up-to-date information from our colleagues is complicated by the difficulties of communication, because the telecommunication networks are down in many parts of the country.
What is happening in Darfur, Western Darfur specifically? What are your partners in Darfur telling you?
The situation in Darfur, in Western Darfur, but also in other parts of Darfur, is extremely difficult. And again, for us, getting in touch with our colleagues in Darfur has been a huge challenge. And also, we just worry for them and for their security. And when we do manage to get in touch with them, unfortunately, the accounts are extremely worrying, because, yes, the fighting is ongoing. People are fleeing. There are shortages of food, of water. We hear that some families only have mango fruit as the only food that is available to them. And one of the biggest concerns for us is the healthcare.
Talking about humanitarian operations within the twin cities of Khartoum, who gives consent or permission to aid agencies to, say, to move from point A to point B?
Well, for us to be able to operate safely, we are in touch with both parties to the conflict, and we can move when we obtain security guarantees from both of them, because there are important priorities, but also we need to make sure that we can deliver assistance without compromising the security of our own staff.
You talked about the health issues or health conditions of people in Darfur and other parts of Sudan. There were reports of hospitals in Khartoum running out of supplies. Talk to us about that situation.
Many hospitals have stopped working. We are now estimating that only 20% of hospitals in Khartoum are still operational. And so it is an urgent priority to support the hospitals that are still working. So the Sudanese healthcare workers, the doctors and nurses, they have been working in extremely difficult conditions, without running water, without electricity, and running low on medical supplies. So we have been coordinating and working with the Ministry of Health to deliver supplies, surgical supplies, to these hospitals. And we have managed to reach 10 hospitals in Khartoum and the outskirts. And of course, this is very small compared to the massive needs, and more needs to be done. But also for us to be able to put in place such a large-scale humanitarian operation, we need a pause in fighting, and we need security for our teams.
Aliyu Onosinenko, a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross, speaking with VOA's John Tanza from the South Sudan in Focus program. Dozens of people were killed by militia in two separate attacks in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Reuters News says more than 40 civilians were killed in a militia attack on a camp for displaced people in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri province early today. A local official and the head of the civil society group told Reuters the Kodeko group, one of many militias operating in Congo's conflict ridden east, was responsible for the killings at the Lal camp. In Beni, North Kivu province, 12 people were killed, including three women allegedly by the militia group ADF. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached reporter Jafar Alkatanti for more on the killings.
Last night, Kodeko, which is a cooperative of the development of Congo, a militia in Ituri attacked an ADP camp in the village of Lala in the district of Dugu and killed 45 IDPs. And those IDPs are the ones fled after many war between Kodeko and the FRDC in the district of Jugu.
Do we know the reason why the people in these IDP camps were killed?
The problem in that region is very complex. You know, that region has lot of gold mining, and the conflict is around the leadership of locals on the mining sector. And there is also an ethnic conflict which is very old than some decades. And Kodeko militia is a Lendu leading. So Lendu people are killing Hema because those locals, those IDPs, are from the Hema community. And Kodeko are Lendu. And as you know, since the past, the Hema and Lendu conflict has made many killed in that region, and some Congolese officers has already been arrested and sent to the ICC tribunal.
So this is more of like a tribal conflict?
Yes, it's a tribal conflict, but what is pushed on because of the mine, that region is very rich, and some people around it want one of that those ethnic to control the mining site. And the mining site is occupied now by Lendu people who are killing all Hema around. And unfortunately, even though the Hema who fled the zone and go in the IDP camp, they are not even more secure because Kodeko can also kill them in the IDP camp. And president of youth in the region said he cannot understand how the Congolese government cannot even protect the IDPs, because if in their villages they were not protected, how also in the IDP camp where they came to seek for protection from the DRC government?
And we understand another rebel group, the ADF, also had some killings in another part of the Eastern DRC?
Yes, some kilometers in south of Ituri, which is in the region of Beni in North Kivu province, the border of Kasindi, was attacked and some citizens were killed. At the moment, 12 bodies were found by locals, and some of them were killed by machete and others by weapon. And let's know that three women are among the bodies found. What I can add is what people, the civil society of Ituri and Beni, are saying. The region has now many forces. UN is there. and there is Shujaa operation between FRDC and UPDF in the region, and also FRDC has also leading another operation. So many operations are in the same region with ADF and against ADF and CODECO, but all of those operations are not succeeding. People are still being killed every day, and the local civil society is not understanding what the government is doing as people are continuing being killed.
That's reporter Jafar Al-Katanti. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga from Goma. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni said Sunday evening still is testing positive for COVID-19, so he will remain in isolation. In a tweet, he said he rested well and indicated he was feeling better. He urged Ugandans to get vaccinated against the virus. He initially tested positive on Wednesday. One of the world's longest-serving leaders, Museveni, has ruled the East African country since 1986. Once hailed as a reformist, he helped end years of tyranny under former leaders Idi Amin and Milton Obote. But the former rebel leader has since cracked down on dissent and changed the constitution to allow himself to contest elections again and again. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Emergency services in South Africa's Gauteng province, including the major cities of Johannesburg and Pretoria, are on high alert following Sunday's earthquake in the region. No injuries have so far been reported, but there is damage to some structures. Darren Taylor reports.
Trembling walls, swaying buildings, barking dogs, blaring home alarms. Just some of the effects of the powerful tremor that shook people awake just before 3 a.m. Sunday across Johannesburg and surrounding areas. The South African Council for Geoscience recorded the quake at a magnitude of 4.7, making it one of the biggest earthquakes in the country in recent memory. The U.S. Geological Survey lists it at a magnitude of 5.
That area has experienced earthquakes in the past. We do expect earthquakes to occur in the future.
Michelle Grobelaar is one of the council's seismologists. She says the East Rand area, where intensive mining has occurred since the 1800s, has a history of seismic events.
Because of what happened in the past, it's more likely to be related to your mining events or your mining activity, and the fact that we're starting to get these mines starting to fill up with water starts to lubricate the faults, so the stresses get released along those faults, and that's what causes these earthquakes.
But independent geologist Dr. Gideon Groenewald says his initial investigation shows the roots of the quake could lie elsewhere.
I think this is probably related to the quakes in Turkey that was very, very serious. The African plate was associated with that quake, and it is highly possible that our plate has just now rebounded a little bit because of that quake. The crack runs from Mozambique to Joburg to East London. The earthquake center epicenter is at about 10 to 17 kilometers underground. None of our mines is that deep. How serious the earth actually moved in Joburg, they will determine in the next 5 or 6 days.
Another seismologist, Willem Menkes, says previous earthquakes in South Africa have injured and even killed people when buildings collapsed. He says structures in the country are supposed to be built according to specifications that protect them, to a degree, from tremors.
So we do have our national building standards and building codes. They do take seismicity of the country and our unique situation into account. That do put on engineering design and construction requirements some additional measures that has to be taken. As new seismic events or earthquakes happen, we do update understanding and analysis of seismicity in South Africa that is then again informed back into our building regulations and design codes.
Groblaar says Gauteng residents should be cautious over the next few days.
Once you get that sort of ground motion, the earth is still trying to settle down to get rid of all those stresses, so one can expect aftershocks to occur. But of course, these aftershocks should be smaller. Sometimes, in fact, people don't really feel them.
The Council for Geoscience is advising people to keep away from multi-story buildings in the quake zone until authorities have inspected to ensure they're safe. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Amnesty International has called on Zimbabwe's president not to sign into law the so-called Patriotic Act that Parliament approved last week. The government says the proposed law, which authorized penalties against people found guilty of damaging Zimbabwe's sovereignty and national interests, is justified and must be enacted. Critics say the law will curb freedom of expression during the August elections. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
On Friday, Amnesty International urged President Emmerson Mnangagwa not to sign the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Amendment Bill 2022, referred to by its supporters as the Patriotic Bill. The bill, if made law, would authorize jail terms of up to 20 years against those found guilt of willfully injuring the sovereignty and the national interest of Zimbabwe. It would also allow the death penalty if a person was found to advocate for international sanctions that harm the country or its people. Amnesty said the proposed law would effectively give authorities greater power to unduly restrict human rights and silence those perceived as being critical of the government, such as political activists, human rights defenders, journalists, civil society leaders, opposition parties, and whistleblowers. Lucia Masuka, the executive director of Amnesty International in Zimbabwe, says her organization is deeply concerned by this week's passing of the bill by the Senate.
The weaponization of the law is really a desperate and patent move to curtail the rights to freedom of expression and to public participation in the elections due in August this year. The bill's deliberately vague and overly broad provisions on damaging Zimbabwe's interests and sovereignty, including by calling for economic sanctions, it flies in the face of Zimbabwe's international human rights obligations. All laws must be defined precisely, allowing people to know exactly which acts will make them criminally liable.
But Ziyambe, Zimbabwe's justice minister, said the proposed law was only targeting citizens who plan on harming the nation with the help of foreigners.
The provision says this: if you go and meet a foreign government or an agent of a foreign government, and that meeting, the intention is to ensure that that particular country imposes a trade embargo on Zimbabwe or sanctions, and you fully participate and you urge them to do that, knowing fully well that your action will injure the sovereignty of the country, you are guilty of an offense. Are you saying it is good?
He added, even if the law passes, Zimbabweans would still be allowed to say anything and even criticize President Mnangagwa. He says the law has nothing to do with Mnangagwa. You can insult him as long as you do not infringe on existing laws, you won't be arrested. We are saying we can disagree, but not to the extent of advocating for the generality of the population to suffer, he said. Musa Kika, a constitutional lawyer who heads the Zimbabwe Human Rights NGO Forum, says it will be unfortunate if President Mnangagwa signs the bill into law.
The government has committed itself to certain governance reforms in line with the arrears and debt clearance process. And under governance, there are issues to do with constitutionalism and civic space, etc. This kind of law, unfortunately, takes back or takes away whatever commitments the government has made in that process. This is an unconstitutional law. It infringes on freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, all sorts of civil and political rights that the Constitution gives.
He added that the bill can be struck off Zimbabwe statutes if it is challenged in court. Batiru Tendo Matinyarare, the chairman of the Zimbabwe anti-sanctions movement, disagrees.
Amnesty International is not a multilateral human rights institution, so they do not qualify to speak on human rights issues. That is the prerogative of the UN Human Rights Council. Secondly, Amnesty International is paid, so it is not an independent institution, but it's an institution that is paid to advance American interests and Western interests over third world interests and African interests. On the issue of the Patriotic Bill, they have not given any evidence how the Patriotic Bill is going to close down the dissent, because there's no way in the Patriotic Bill that it says that Zimbabweans are not allowed to criticize their government.
President Mnangagwa has not said when or if he will sign the bill into law. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
An estimated 25 million Nigerian citizens are living with various forms of disabilities. In 2019, Nigeria enacted a disability law to promote inclusivity, but rights groups say the law hasn't the status quo and many people still feel marginalized. One Nigerian newspaper has created a way to reach more visually impaired Nigerians. Timothy Obiesu reports from Abuja.
When Eleonora Boyer gets to work every morning, she browses her phone for news stories. But with a visual impairment, she relies on voice commands to call up websites, and oftentimes she encounters difficulties.
I cannot access some websites or some applications with my screen reader, and which makes getting information very difficult.
Boyer's vision started deteriorating after birth, and she was later diagnosed with glaucoma. Some 25 million Nigerians are estimated to be living with disabilities and constitute one of the poorest segments of the population. Too often, they say, they are marginalized. But in May, a Nigerian online newspaper, The Cable, launched what it calls a disability inclusive news application, or DINA, to give people with visual impairments access to information through a built-in talkback function. Boyer says the app has been helpful.
When I downloaded it and went through it, it was really good. It was accessible for me. My screen reader could use it. And also, I saw that some of the prints were very bold, which is also accessible for, you know, persons who are visually impaired but not totally blind.
DINA is considered Nigeria's first disability-friendly news application and was selected as one of the winners of the Google News Innovation Challenge in 2022. Kolapo Olapoju is an editor at The Cable.
We fight for persons with disabilities as, you know, media stakeholders. We do so through our reports, through some of the advocacies that we do. However, we also forget that we have to actually provide solutions for them. And we move past the era of traditional media. We are in the era of digital media.
Stephen Idoko, a program manager at the Abuja-based nonprofit Inclusive Friends Association, says the news app should also help people who are deaf and need captions.
This kind of innovation shouldn't just be limited to the blind. We should also try to factor other cluster of disabilities into play. It is important that alternative images are provided in such publications online for the deaf.
Nigerian authorities signed the Disability Bill into law in 2019 after many years of advocacy and protest by disability rights groups. But critics in Nigeria say the law has yet to be properly implemented. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Zubair Al-Tayeb, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.